podcast. I'm Jace. This episode is a Top Cow Thursday episode, even though it's coming out extremely late on Thursday, early Friday. Again, apologize for the technical difficulties yesterday with the new Comics Wednesday episode. Kind of put us a little behind. We don't normally release episodes on Fridays, though, so we should be able to use that day to get us back on track for the Saturday episode, which is Secret Wars Chronology. So without further delay, let me dive into Top Cow. This Top Cow Thursday episode is going to be all about the books that were released from Top Cow on Wednesday, January 10th. They had three releases, if I remember correctly. Witchblade number 2, a relaunch of that classic property from Top Cow. Also the third issue of Port of Earth. And I believe they also had a trade that came out. I just want to verify that. Postal. Their series about a witness protection in reverse, if you will. We have volume 6 of that that came out. So I hope you got out to your local comic shop and picked up some Top Cow issues. They're one of my favorite publishers. Just because they put out such high-quality stories. I think in the past, Top Cow in the 90s had a kind of reputation of being a bad girl publisher, and that partially to do with Witchblade itself and the debut of that series with that incredible Michael Turner art. It was very much of its time. Manny and I have talked on the Top Cow Chronology episodes of the Comic Source podcast about that in the past. So in getting ready to talk about these two issues, the word that kept popping up in my mind was mood. If there's anything these two comics have in common, that it really not just the two issues of these two particular series, but the series overall themselves up to this point, they really have in common is mood. And it's a lot to do with the way the stories are being told, but even more to do with the art in the books. And I want to talk about that first of all. The creators on the titles, and let me get that creative lineup for you here. So we'll start with Port of Earth first. Written by Zach Kaplan. The art is by Andrea Moody. And the colors are by Vladimir Popov. Now, generally speaking, when it comes to comic art, I prefer clean lines. You know, I like the art to look, I don't know if pretty is the right word, but I think clean probably sums it up relatively well. And, you know, when you talk about superhero comics, that's generally what you get for the most part. The artists that are, you know, most popular tend to have art that's more, you know, on the clean side of things. Think Jim Lee, think the aforementioned Michael Turner, guys like that, right? It's very pleasing to the eye in a way that you're portraying action, you're portraying the story clearly, with clearly delineated lines. And, you know, it looks polished, it looks finished. There's not much of a, you know, a sketch-like quality to it. And again, that's pretty typical of artists that are most popular in comics today, at least the mainstream stuff and the superhero stuff for sure. But that's not necessarily the case in Port of Earth or in this new Witchblade volume for that matter. And let me go over the creative team for Witchblade real quick. Written by Caitlin Kittredge. The art is by Roberta Ingranata. And the colors are by Brian Valenza. And again, the art in Witchblade, just like with Port of Earth, it's not, you know, super clean. It's not polished or refined. And normally, under normal circumstances, I don't necessarily appreciate that kind of art as much. But in these two books, it works. And there are times where, even though it's not my favorite kind of art, I have to recognize the fact that it suits the story very well, and it's almost done purposefully. And I should say it is done purposefully, because again, it all comes back to that word mood. Let's talk about Port of Earth first. The book's a train wreck. Well, actually, let me rephrase that. The story's a train wreck. Not to say the story is bad, but much like a train wreck or a car accident where you come upon it and you can't look away, you know bad things are going on, you know this is not something that's good, but you have that sense of morbid curiosity and you can't look away. That's Port of Earth, right? That's the situation that Zach Kaplan has set up. The story plays out kind of two different storylines, the big overall political aspect of it, and then the down on the street level story about some security officers who are in the thick of it, you know, who are right there having visceral contact and having their lives directly affected by the decisions that have been made by the powers that be. So Port of Earth is the story that in the future, Earth has gotten itself into a deal. Aliens finally made contact, and they've come not in peace, not looking to conquer, not looking to gouge our planet for resources or be some kind of benevolent mentor, but rather they've just come with a deal. They want to use Earth and its plentiful resource of ocean water as a port, right? They've come with a deal. And we're learning, or seems to me, as the reader, that this wasn't necessarily the best deal. Wasn't necessarily the best bed to make. But the decision makers have made that bed, and now we have to lie in it. And based on the first three issues, everything is not as it seems. So that's the big political story, right? The overview, the setting that we find ourselves in. And we're kind of learning about that bigger picture through part of the story, which is a reporter named Julia Campbell interviewing the head of the Earth Security Agency, who's charged with security at this port, which has been built in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of California near San Francisco. The more visceral, the more hands-on part of the story is the story of two, I don't want to say security guards, but maybe we'll call them agents, ESA or security agency agents named Mac and George. And we meet them. They're chasing an alien who's left the port. And part of the deal was no alien was ever supposed to leave the port. Humans weren't allowed in the port. It's completely separate, right? But we learned through some news reports, shown kind of flashbacks, and part of the reason the Earth Security Agency was founded is because at some various times over the years since this port has been built, aliens have left the port. So as I said, we meet Mac and George, and they're pursuing an alien who's left the port. And they have an interesting relationship, Mac and George. Mac seems to be very cynical. He seems to be carrying a chip on his shoulder. Doesn't seem to have any particular love for the aliens. To the point where you almost wonder, like, how did this guy, like, get his job? How did he keep his job? How is he not drummed out? He seems to be very prejudiced against the aliens. Whereas George is nearly, as his partner, you know, you find this to be fascinating, his polar opposite, right? Like, seems to be very much an optimist, seems to be very open-minded, seems to want to give the aliens the benefit of the doubt. But yet he doesn't question George's attitude, which I wonder about. I find it fascinating that he reluctantly gives in to George's lead and George's decision-making constantly. So I find that to be interesting. In a way, it makes George seem like the weaker character, but I'm not necessarily sure that's true. And it makes Mac, his attitude toward the aliens, it makes Mac somewhat unlikable. And in a way, I feel like these two characters are kind of indicative of kind of the two prevailing attitudes in the world today, like the political upheaval that we have in this country. You know, those that seem to just want to get angry and engage, you know, whether, you know, no matter what your belief is, and those that just don't necessarily want to bury their head in the sand, because George certainly is involved and certainly is aware, but doesn't seem, at least to this point, and granted, it's only three issues in, doesn't seem to necessarily be doing anything to try to remedy the situation. Seems like he's kind of holding back. He's just kind of adopting a wait-and-see attitude and just kind of hoping things get better. But I have a feeling that may change, and we may see a lot of growth from George as a character. Mac, I'm less sure about if we're going to see growth, but it certainly wouldn't surprise me based on the strength of Zach Kaplan's writing, specifically on the other title he does for Top Cow, which is Eclipse. If you're not reading that, I highly, highly recommend it. But as I said, the story, the situation itself is a bit of a train wreck, and you really see that in the other kind of plot that's going on with the reporter, as I said, Julia Campbell, interviewing Tom Ruckers. You know, at one point in issue two, she asks him if Earth got the better deal, and he says unequivocally, yes, you know, we got this technology, it's basically free energy, we now have the water engine where we can turn ocean water into energy. And Julia basically confronts him with the consequences of that kind of overnight change in the Earth's energy supply. But he's not hearing any of it. And we learn that, you know, the people that made the decisions, or the decision to allow this port to be built on Earth, didn't necessarily do it for any altruistic reason or to advance human society, but they did it basically to line their own pockets. You know, they're the ones that had the access to the technology. They're the ones that made the decision. They're the ones who are better off. Whereas the, you know, man on the street isn't necessarily in a better place. The Earth isn't necessarily in a better place for having this port of call, this stopover for these alien ships. And we also learn early on, I think it's at, right at the beginning of issue two, that this quote-unquote consortium that came offering this deal wasn't some, you know, benevolent or advanced or United Nations type organization from the stars, but much more like, you know, Exxon Mobil. You know, they're just a gas station. They're just in it for the profit. They're just in it for themselves, not to, you know, advance their civilizations or in the sake of, you know, harmony in the galaxy and unity and working together. So with this kind of attitude of everybody looking out for themselves, you can't help but think that it's, you know, this is just going to be a disaster. So again, I think the world that Zach has created is an interesting one. I think it's much like some of the best comics I'm enjoying reading right now. It's very reflective of our current state of affairs in the world today. And you know, not to get too terribly deep, but I've said many times before that I feel like a culture and a society can very accurately be examined through its fiction, through the stories that it's trying to tell. So if you look back at certain eras of humanity and look at what their fiction was at that time, it's an interesting view into the way society and culture were at that time. So we look back at the snapshot of, you know, the 2010s and look at stories like Port of Earth, the upheaval, the unrest in these stories and in these worlds that are being created are very reflective of the time period they're created in. And I think there's value in that. So I definitely recommend Port of Earth. There's very much a what have they gotten themselves into kind of feel to it. And again, it's a lot about the mood, which is set so well by that the gritty artwork of Andrea Moody. It's done very well, and you know, the earth looks, it doesn't look polished, it doesn't look clean, it doesn't look, you know, like some shiny Star Trek future where things are positive. It looks like somewhat slum-like, you know, like, wow, they're in a mess. They've gotten themselves into something they should have never been involved in. And this, you know, you have the added mystery of why this alien has escaped the port and what's going on with that. And, you know, have the reactions of the two agents and their differing viewpoints on the world, all set in the backdrop of this, you know, politically charged situation. And you definitely get a feel of unrest. And again, it's created expertly by the art of Andrea Moody. And even though Manny couldn't be on this episode to talk about it, I'm going to put a link in the show notes to his written review of issue 2 over on LRM Online. And he talks about the ticking time bomb that Zach has set up, and the fact that we've, you know, have found out that this consortium is much more ExxonMobil than United Nations, and what the implications of that are. So if you want to know a little bit about Manny's thoughts, as I said, I'll put the link in the show notes. So in my opinion, it's definitely worth reading. It's another home run for Zach Kaplan. Interesting because, you know, his Eclipse title does share some similarities with Port of Earth in that, you know, it's set in the not too distant future. The world's not in a great place. And we have some kind of POV characters, some point of view characters that are kind of down to earth characters that are really in the thick of it. They're both law enforcement officers in a way. I'm enjoying, you know, Eclipse immensely. I'm enjoying Port of Earth so far, but I'm really looking forward to his next project, even to see if he kind of gets out of that kind of section that he's been in. You know, as I said, these two stories have similarities. It'd be crazy to see him do something like way out there from these two stories, like, you know, some classic superhero stories, or what would he do on a, you know, a Superman title or something like that. It'd be very, very interesting. Next time I see Zach, I'll have to talk to him about that. So let me move on to Witchblade, issue 2. As I said, wow. Is it okay if I say I'm not sure if I like it yet or not? You know, being such a Top Cow fan, I don't know if that's sacrilege or not. It's certainly interesting. And I think that if you called this book something else, I'd be more inclined to say that I like it. But I think I'm bringing in, you know, I'm bringing in my history and my knowledge of the past Witchblade title. And I can't help but compare the two. And based on the fact that the first Witchblade, first few issues were drawn by my favorite comic artist ever, Michael Turner, I'm finding it, you know, hard to try to stay completely objective. Again, it's not the style of art that I prefer in my comics. Roberta Ingranata, again, is the artist, but I'm trying to keep an open mind because this art does do a very good job of setting the mood, right? Just like I said. When I look back at the first couple issues of the original Witchblade comic, it seemed like the story progressed a little bit faster. we kind of knew where we stood with the Witchblade, and it seemed a little more action oriented, but maybe not quite as cerebral and certainly not as emotional. There's a lot of emotion that the writer Caitlin Kittredge is kind of establishing for our main character, Alex Underwood. I don't know that we really knew much about the bearer of the Witchblade in the first title, Sarah Pazzini, as far as her emotional state, other than kind of surprise at getting these powers and some anger at the situation she was in. Alex is a much more complex character in the first couple issues of Witchblade as opposed to Sarah. So again, I guess maybe it's a little more to do with the times that these stories were written in. One was in the 90s and this is in 2017, first issue came out. So again, it's back to that idea of the stories and the titles are kind of reflecting the time that they're in. Not to say there weren't complex problems in the 90s, but and maybe it's just the tendency to for us as humans to look back on bygone times, like it's funny to think of the 90s as bygone times, but looking back to the past, it always seems like things were simpler and they only get more complicated for us as a culture and a society and politically as we move forward. But again, this character of Alex Underwood, we're not sure what the Witchblade is. I think that I've read a few articles and a few reviews and a few interviews with Caitlin where she talks about the fact that this is a kind of a whole new take on the Witchblade and the Artifact universe. But it just seems so different. We haven't necessarily seen Alex in any sort of costume. We haven't gotten a really good look at what the Witchblade itself, like how it manifests and what it does. We've just got kind of a vague impression, look like some kind of green tentacles. So again, I'm trying to keep an open mind, but I can't help but, as I said, look back and compare it to the first couple issues of the original Witchblade, where it had that stylized costume. It had a very distinct look, rendered beautifully by Michael Turner. And so it's probably not necessarily fair, but I can't help it. I wish I could, because again, I think if you called this title something else and didn't associate it with the Artifact corner of the Top Cow universe at all, I would say I'm enjoying it more. But it does, it does come with that history. And so I am interested to see where it goes. But at this point, I'll say after the first two issues, there's much more questions than answers. I'm not sure. It's not what I expected. I'll put it that way. But sometimes we can be surprised by having things not meet our expectations or go in a different direction than we expect it to. So there are definitely some interesting characters. Alex herself seems to be very complex. I do like the fact that there's been a tendency recently, and again, I hate to harp on it, but again, it goes back to be a reflection of where we are culturally and in our society right now with starting to acknowledge, gender equality and realizing that, for as far as we've come, there are still so many ways that women are not treated equally because of their gender. Almost to the point where there are times I feel like I'm persecuted for the fact that I'm a man. And I shouldn't say like personally, but I just look out there like, in general, it's like, man, it's tough to be a dude these days when there's all these, accusations and in stories, things like I was having a conversation today with some coworkers about look at the most recent Star Wars movie, The Last Jedi, where it's the women that have all the good ideas and the men who keep messing up, and they appear, you know, somewhat inept when compared to the women, and the women are constantly having to show the men how their thinking is wrong, or they have to be saved from themselves from their poor decision making, and they don't seem as intelligent as the women. And it's almost like the pendulum has swung too far, right? And I'm certainly not complaining. You know, I live life on the easiest setting, right? I'm a white, straight male. I have nothing to complain about. But it's just interesting in that this is reflective of part of the theme that we see right now in comics with all these strong female characters. And there's so many people saying, well, it's about time. And I do agree with them to some degree, because I feel like, and, you know, Phil Jimenez and I have talked about this at great length. You want comics to be reflective of the world around you. You want there to be a comic out there for everybody. So you need there to be characters that anybody can walk into a comic shop and find a character they identify with, you know, whether they're male, female, regardless of the color of their skin. You want them to be able to find characters that they can relate to, that they can look at and put themselves in their position, in their situations, and see the world through the eyes of that character. You know, that's almost a definition of, you know, escapism, of fantasy, of for me, what's so awesome about comics is being able to read a story about a character who you can put yourself in their place, right? You can use your imagination. You know, I can imagine myself being Superman or Batman or, you know, whatever. It's much harder to do if, you know, you're a female and there's no female characters to read about, or every female character you read about is weak or constantly making bad decisions or doesn't look like you whatsoever. So it's okay that we are where we are. I think it's good and it's healthy that we are where we are. As it pertains to Witchblade, the first couple issues, I love what Caitlin has done as the writer. You know, she hasn't created this superheroic female character that, you know, has it all together and has all the answers. She's much more real. You know, she's much more, you can tell there's a strength there, but there's also some fragility. You know, there's some things that still need to be resolved. There's things that she needs to work on, you know, as a person. And so, again, it's making the character relatable to the people that are reading their story and being able to put yourself in that position. And in that way, the first couple issues of Witchblade have been incredible. She's done a great job of kind of establishing that. And again, the art by Ingranata suits that sort of mood, you know, in that it's not clean. It doesn't reflect the fact that, you know, this is super slick and super stylized and you know, clean, and it's a character that has the answers, and it's all in service to the story. Rather, it's completely the other way. It's you know, impressionist to some degree. It's, well, what's the mood that's trying to be conveyed? Well, it's one of a little bit of confusion because Alex doesn't know what's happening to her. And we, as the reader, in these first couple issues, you know, we know that she's gained this power of the Witchblade, but we don't know what exactly that means because it's such a new take on the concept of the Witchblade. And what is the Witchblade? And where did it come from? And how does it manifest itself? We've gotten some answers from another one of the characters in the book, a male who it looks like he's trying to help Alex, but is doing so on his own terms in such a way that he doesn't have belief in her. He doesn't have faith in her because she's still questioning, constantly questioning, and not just taking and doing what he says. And he doesn't believe that she's going to survive the first couple days of the Witchblade. And so why should he waste his time? So there's an interesting dynamic going on there as well. So, I think, my biggest complaint is just that the story hasn't progressed as far as I feel that the Witchblade, I feel like after the first couple issues of the first volume, I knew so much more than I know here. But again, I don't necessarily think that's fair. That's just kind of my first impression. But I do recognize the fact that Kittredge has spent more of the storytelling and real estate, if you will, establishing mood and establishing characterization for Alex Underwood than the first volume did. So it may be after, I don't know, I think giving it another four issues, probably around issue six, it'd probably be a little more fair to compare, so think of like one trade paperback worth of story of volume one of Witchblade versus one trade paperback worth of story from volume two, and then compare the two. But again, it's human nature for me, and I know that first volume of Witchblade, the early part of it anyway, so well, that it's hard not to compare. So keeping an open mind about it, I definitely think it's worth reading. It's worth picking up, especially for someone who doesn't have any history with Witchblade. Like if you haven't read the first volume, I'd be really curious to know somebody coming in at it with fresh eyes what their thoughts are. So if you've picked up Witchblade volume two, the first couple issues, but you've never read the original, please reach out and let me know your thoughts. I'd be very curious to know. So that's going to do it for this episode of the Comic Source Podcast, this Top Cow Thursday episode. Once again, I'd like to thank everyone for joining us. Just a reminder that we are still planning on moving over very soon exclusively over to have all our content hosted on LRM Online. But in the meantime, you can still go to thecomicsourceblog.com to find all past episodes of the podcast, as well as links to our YouTube channel there. You can also find our famous sketch gallery there as well. Do a search for us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. You can also find us by doing a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram. That's really the best place to, those three places, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. I always post on there whenever new episodes come up, and you can find links and information about conventions we're going to be at as well. So thanks for joining us, everybody, and we'll talk to you next time.